Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Over the past 100 years, our understanding of how the universe works has changed dramatically as technology has improved in leaps and bounds. But is the standard cosmological model keeping up, or is it too simplistic and outdated? Some cosmologists believe so. And last week, many of them gathered at the London Royal Society to challenge the fundamental assumptions that underpin the conventional understanding of how everything works. So to help us unpack some of these hefty and somewhat technical topics is one of the conference's organisers, Oxford University Professor Subir Sarkar. He joins us now from the UK. Professor Sarkar, good morning and thanks very much for joining us here on Nights.
Well, good evening. Thanks for playing that lovely song. I actually met Gagarin when he came to India shortly after his joust into space. I was 8 years old.
No way.
I think it was the winter of 61, yeah.
Wow.
Well, you know, he was a celebrity at the time. Everywhere he went,
crowds
came to see him.
I bet he was. So have you been into space, as it were, since you were knee-high to a grasshopper, as they say?
Well, of course, I mean, everyone was into it at the time.
Yeah.
I mean, it did, in a sense, change our perception of how we connect to the universe. In the sense, here were people saying we could actually go out and explore it, not just look at it from down here. Mm-hmm. The issues that we debated last week in London are to do with the sort of bigger picture of the universe.
Yeah.
And listening to what you just said, I think I should first point out that, you know, cosmology is, of course, a pretty, I guess it is the first, you know, intellectual activity, if you like, of humankind anywhere. Every culture in history has its cosmology. And what we were talking about really is sort of modern scientific cosmology, which is based in physics and astronomy, not the kind of cosmology that, say, you know, ancient cultures have. I mean, the Aboriginals have a different cosmology than the Mayans did, than the ancient Hindus, the Chinese,
indeed,
and so forth. About the cosmological model, even if you focus on just Europe, you will know that there was a cosmological model which ruled for 2,000 years. This was due to people like Ptolemy and Aristotle, the ancient Greeks. And in that cosmological model, the universe was perfect. The sky had to be perfect. Even when new stars appeared in the sky, supernovae, such as the one that a New Zealander first saw in February 1987, you might remember, supernova 1987A in the Magellanic Cloud. The Europeans have no record of such things because it had been decreed that the sky was perfect.
Right.
And so it could not be blemished by a new star appearing. So anyway, let's fast forward to, the, as you said, the last 100 years. So you have got beyond that. We have accepted that we construct a cosmology according to what we actually observe, rather than, according to religious or philosophical prescription. However, it is still true that since cosmology was founded at a time when we had absolutely no knowledge of the rest of the universe. So the first paper that our model rests on was in 1922, a Russian cosmologist. In fact, he was a meteorologist, Alexander Friedman. And at that time, we didn't even know that we live in, you know, one galaxy amongst 100 billion others.
Wow.
This was 1922.
Of course, yeah.
And we didn't know that there were other galaxies. We didn't know that they are all going away from us. The universe is expanding. All those discoveries came about, 7 to 10 years later. So it started by making the simplest possible assumption you can. So going back to what the Greeks said, they said, you know, the Earth is the center of the universe and everything goes around us, which is basically how it looks on the sky. And it took a real leap of, you know, a logical deduction from data to execute what we call today the Copernican Revolution. The realization that we are not the center of the universe. We go around the sun like all the other planets, etc. And that was psychologically rather important because it, of course, demoted us from being at the center of things. But then in cosmology, we kind of took another step and we said, well, we see the universe from one particular vantage point, but there must can't be anything special about it. So every point must be equivalent. And so the universe must look the same from every point. And therefore, the universe has to be, on the whole, very isotropic and homogeneous, which means nothing can change according to what direction you look at or what point you observe from. And that makes for a very simple universe mathematically. It's then tractable because the underlying physical theory is Einstein's theory of general relativity, which is notoriously difficult to sort of solve. We know it's a correct description as far as we have tested it, but to find actual mathematical solutions which describe things in general relativity is usually much easier if we assume a great deal of symmetry, as in the standard cosmological model that I just told you about, where we say that the universe is very simple on the whole. It's smooth and when averaged over large scales, and it is isotropic, it's the same in every direction. So in a nutshell, in non-technical language, that would be what I would say is the conventional view of the universe that we have today.
Right. Okay. That's fascinating, and that's a good sort of introduction to this topic. I suppose, you know, it gets to that idea that we want things to be simple for our little human brains, really, don't we? And oftentimes they turn out to be much more complicated, and we have to catch up to them.
Also, it makes our job as physicists easier. We like, you know, we like problems we can solve.
Yeah. So, talk to me a bit about the challenges to these fundamental assumptions. You know, when did challenges to these assumptions that were formulated, as you say, in sort of the early to mid-20th century, when did they start to emerge, and what, by and large, was the nature of the questions that were being asked, the challenges that were being made here?
Well, so after we kind of developed telescopes and learned to look at the distant universe and map it out, and discovered that, you know, we are one galaxy, as I said, amongst 100 billion others. We have tried to understand what the, you know, what the universe, as we all know, is expanding. So, but we have to understand how it originated, why is it expanding, what will be its future. These are all the kind of questions that are addressed in cosmology. And a big advance was when we realized this started about now in the 1980s, I would say, so 40 years ago, we started developing, on top of this cosmological model, a model for how the structure that we see in the universe formed. So by structure, I mean, you know, galaxies, and galaxies are in rich clusters of galaxies, the clusters are in superclusters. You see on the sky this amazing, what has been called the cosmic web of structure. And the amazing thing is that we today actually think we can get a reasonably sound understanding of how all that came to be purely from gravitational instability. In other words, structure forms because, you know, two particles attract each other. That's enough to then attract a third, and the process sort of carries on, and condensations form in what was otherwise previously a homogeneous, smooth background. But to do this, you need initial small perturbations or fluctuations. And when we learned to look at the sky in different ways, when we learned to look at it in microwaves, we saw that we can actually look back as far as we can towards the Big Bang. And we see the cosmic microwave background, which is like a radiation covering the whole sky. That's from the Big Bang. but it has been redshifted. It has been stretched out to microwave frequencies, so we can't see it with our eyes. You know, there is this old puzzle of why is the sky dark at night? Why aren't all the stars covered? Well, there is a bright sky, but it is not at optical wavelengths. We can't see it with our eyes, but we can detect it with instruments. And this microwave background has little fluctuations on it, and we have figured out that those little fluctuations are actually small inhomogeneities in the distribution of matter, and they could have grown under gravity to give us the structure we see on the sky today, which is quite a big development in cosmology, right? So this is the success.
Okay.
But you asked what is the kind of big issue? The big issue is that when we make this assumption of isotropy and homogeneity and we analyze the data that has now come in the last 40 years or 50 years, we come to the amazing conclusion that the universe, the dominant component of the universe, is not matter that we are made of or radiation, like, you know, light. Mm-hmm. They constitute only a small fraction of everything, less than 5%. Mm-hmm. Most of the universe is supposed to be dark.
Yes.
There is supposed to be, you would have heard of dark matter.
Dark matter.
Is what we need.
Yeah.
Yeah. Without dark matter, that structure I mentioned could not grow to be the galaxies that we see today in the available time, because we know how old the universe is and it takes time for things to grow. But more important than dark matter is, of course, a big puzzle. And there are, as you know, many approaches to try to detect it directly rather than just infer its existence from the fact that it, you know, supports the growth of perturbations into galaxies. Mm-hmm. We infer that about 2/3 of the universe, the energy density, is in the form of the energy density of, now this is a big one, we think it is quantum fluctuations of the vacuum. I mean, you know, it sounds like a very weird thing, but this is the real story, that over the last 50 years, we have also come to understand that what we call particles, you know, electrons, protons, everything we know, they're all vibrations, they're all excitations of the fundamental objects that we understand today are called fields. They pervade the entire universe. So, for example, electromagnetic radiation, which you are familiar with, mm-hmm. right? Light. Mm-hmm. Light is an excitation of the electromagnetic field.
Okay.
And in fact, it has been known since the 19th century. You know, Maxwell formulated its laws long ago. Mm-hmm. And similarly, the electron in our body, the quarks in our bodies, they're all excitations of corresponding fields. Quantum fields. These are. This is actually the most amazing thing you have. I think you have learned about the nature of matter. Mm. But that then makes us also realize that these quantum objects, you know about Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. You can't have quantum things ever at rest. They're always fluctuating.
Okay.
Because of that. So all these fields have so-called zero-point fluctuations, which means even in the ground state, in the lowest energy possible state, they're still, fluctuating. They don't have zero energy. And these energies add up to a huge amount. So if these energies affect the expansion of the universe, as Einstein said, every kind of energy should do that mm-hmm. in his theory of general relativity, then we have a big problem, because on the one hand, it looks, the observations seem to be telling us that about 2/3 of the universe is this vacuum energy mm-hmm. of primordial fields. But there's a little problem. The energy, the amount of energy that is required to blow the universe up at the rate that we are seeing it today is a tiny number compared to the actual energy density in the fields that we are investigating at, say, the Large Hadron Collider in Geneva. Uh-huh. We know that we do these experiments at big machines where we try to investigate the structure of matter on smaller and smaller scales. And we have investigated down to scales of the order of something like 10 to the minus 16th of a centimeter.
Wow.
That's about a thousandth of the size of a nucleus.
Uh-huh.
We are confident about our understanding of physics down to there, or maybe even a factor of 10 beyond that. Mm. And that, according to our field theory, would tell us that there is a vacuum energy in the universe whose magnitude is at least 1 followed by 60 zeros times bigger than the amount that we are inferring
right.
from the expansion of the universe. So in other words, we have a nice description of the universe in terms of these pretty pictures and saying that 2/3 of the universe is vacuum energy, but it has no physical basis at all. It's the biggest, I would say it is the biggest problem in theoretical physics, this trying understanding of why the energy density of the vacuum does not gravitate. Because if it did, we would not be here talking about it.
Can I ask you something? And it's a slightly facetious question, but I imagine that it's one that you do get a lot and probably get a bit sick of answering. Why does this matter?
Well, obviously, it doesn't make any difference to our everyday lives. Apart from the fact that our lives, if you like, have meaning only because we have questions about
yeah.
things that don't directly affect us. I mean, you know, you would say all of art is in that category.
Yeah.
None of it is relevant to putting food in your belly, right? And, you mm-hmm. know, poetry is not about sort of making money. Mm-hmm. And yet we read books, we go to the theater, we admire paintings, we look at the sunsets and, you know, we feel a sense of connection to the universe. And that's what makes us human. And what we are doing in scientific research is part of the same, you know, being sentient beings, looking at the universe.
Yeah. And yes, exactly. Yes. One of the points of existence, I suppose, is curiosity about the world around you and a sort of hunger to find out about
yes.
it. Yeah. Go ahead.
Can I add, it's also true that in the process of doing this, we do occasionally find things, not even by deliberately looking for them.
Yeah.
But for example, one of our ex-students from Oxford here, who was at CERN working in the computing department, he happened to invent a little thing called the World Wide Web
yes.
In order to, you know, enable people working there from all over the world to be able to communicate in real time. And you know what that has done to the world, right? Mm-hmm. And that was not invented by Microsoft or IBM and it has been given free to the world,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
So we do occasionally, people do things that I think also provide value for money, if you like.
Mm.
But that's not our main concern. We don't do it for that reason.
It's it must be curious that meetings like this, and sort of, I suppose, getting back to that point that you made at the beginning when, you know, for a long time we operated on the assumption that we were at the center of the universe, partly because it was convenient, you know, it was convenient for us because we can say, well, we're the center of the universe. Everything else moves around us.
And basically, that's how it looks on the sky.
Yeah,
right?
You exactly.
see the sun going around every day.
And it means, I suppose, as well, that some questions, you know, that there are fewer questions because that is such a wonderful
exactly.
answer, I suppose. You know, in a way, religion has been used like that and historically
exactly.
as well. It's like that just because it's like that. When you are at meetings like this with other cosmologists and you are debating your ideas and presenting your theories and so on and so forth, it must be quite humbling because you must know that in 50 years, 100 years, 200 years, everything will be different once again as our knowledge continues to grow. It must be quite an interesting experience for you all being there.
Absolutely. And actually, since you mentioned that, there was a gentleman in the audience who turned out to be a sociologist. So at the end of the meeting, we had a kind of a discussion panel, and I invited anyone from the audience to say what they had thought. It was only a two-day meeting, but what impression they had taken away from it. And this gentleman got up and he said he was a sociologist, not a cosmologist. Mm-hmm. And he had just come there because, you know, he knew a cosmologist who had persuaded him to come along. And I must say, I was very pleased that he said, I thought you guys were, you know, really arrogant. You think you know about the whole universe and et cetera. And we have, you know, in sociology, very much understand the limits to truth and limits to, you know, how we construct the universe, as it were, to our own purposes. And he said he had been very struck by Well, I feel embarrassed saying this. He said, how humble we were, he said. And of course, we're really chuffed to hear that.
I bet, yeah.
Because indeed we are, I suppose, it don't even need to be a non, even within science, people often think, cosmologists must be really arrogant if they think they can make sense of something as vast and complex as the universe. And the truth is, of course, we don't when we can try to make sense of it. And then we come up against hurdles like the one I mentioned, that we have today a standard model of the universe, which fits the data, but it doesn't make any sense in its physical underpinnings. So I see that as an opportunity. It means we are missing something big, and there is something for, the next generation, or for that matter, even the current generation to figure out.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not all done and dusted. When we first enter research, young people are often kind of phased by the huge amount of work that has been done before them. And they think, what am I going to contribute? It's all been done by much smarter people than me. And, I would tell them, look, it's not all been done, because our present understanding, even by all those clever people, clearly leaves something to be desired. And, you might be the one to do it.
Sudhir, we have about 30 seconds left. I have one final question for you this evening.
Sure.
What is the right collective noun for a group of cosmologists, please?
Well, there you have me. I think you should put that as a competition.
I've already done it. I've already done it. Suggestions include a cluster, a star cluster, and a critical density of cosmologists, and indeed a galaxy of cosmologists.
Well, a galaxy of cosmologists would be the thing to
that
do.
Feels about right.
That feels about right.
So, dear,
but yes, I think
we'll
that's
have to,
nice to.
We have to call it there, I'm afraid, Sudhir Sarkar. We're heading into the news, but it's been a delight chatting to you this evening. Thank you for your time.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.